The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Sarah Keogh is sitting over there. She is expert dietitian, founder of Eat Well, and drops in on occasion to answer questions relating to diet and allergies and all the rest of it. And if you have any of those, 53106, that'll cost you 30 cents. If you want to do it for free, you can use WhatsApp and go 087 1400 106. Sarah, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. You're going to be kept busy as always. We have one. I like these ones that I can't pronounce. So let's start with those. Tech saying, I have been told I am allergic to limonene and linalool. What foods should I avoid? What is limonene and linalool?
They are compounds that, to be honest, are largely, I'm fairly sure they're extracted kind of from animal products, and they're usually used in cosmetics. They're flavouring. So lemon and lemonish flavouring, things like that in there. Don't see them a massive amount in foods, but they'll be on ingredient lists. So they're generally added in to add flavours to things. But I've more would be associating them with cosmetics. So you'd get them a lot as scent in shampoos and things like that. So it's probably looking at cosmetic products more so than foods. I've not really seen them as an additive in foods a huge amount. But I'd be just checking sort of ingredient lists for them with that.
Do you get a commonality of allergy between things that you eat and things that you put on your body? If you are celiac,
not necessarily.
No.
So celiacs can rub gluten all over their skin. I don't recommend it before anybody rushes out and does it. And certainly what we'll get is sometimes if people, some products that maybe are oat-based but wouldn't be gluten-free, if people are using a lot of them, they're, you know, it might do. But with celiac, it's specifically triggered if you swallow it. So you can breathe in flour and it won't do you any harm, but if you swallow the flour, it does. So not necessarily sometimes.
Which isn't the case with nuts, because nut dust, if you breathe it in, can cause you problems.
Yeah, so it depends on what the reaction actually is. And it's a little bit different for each person with that.
Can I ask you a vegetable related question?
Okay.
There's a sense that for a vegetable to be of any use, it has to be in its natural form and identifiable as itself. If you chop them up and you put them in a chili or in a pasta sauce or anything else, do they cease to be valuable vegetables?
Oh, no, they're still fantastic. And I get this all the time. Should you have your vegetables raw or cooked? So both. It's actually very good for your body to get both. And that's because cooking, you will lose some of, say, the heat-sensitive vitamins, and you'll lose some of the water-soluble ones. But you won't lose all of them. You lose a bit, but definitely not all. So they still have huge nutrition. But cooking activates some of the antioxidants in food. So things like some of the antioxidants like lycopene and things like tomatoes are actually activated by cooking. So things like carrots and tomatoes are actually slightly better for you cooked than raw. Now, they still have tremendous value raw. So what we actually know, and even from sort of a gut bacteria point of view, some raw, some cooked, some lightly cooked, some boiled to death. Like it actually doesn't matter.
But they don't have to be standalone.
No, they definitely don't. Soup, like soup is just wonderful. You know, because you've cooked all these lovely veg and then, you know, and it's great for getting, you know, if people don't like.
See, I always thought that didn't count as vegetable, but vegetable soup counts as vegetable.
Vegetable soup counts as one serving of your sort of five a day. So
while we're on this line, does tomato count? I know tomato technically isn't a vegetable, but does it count as a vegetable?
Do you know? No. But tomato puree does. So a dessert spoon of tomato puree counts as one of your sort of five to seven a day.
How can tomato puree
so concentrated? So it's really concentrated down tomato. So the levels of nutrients in it actually are huge with that. So it's
so a dessert spoon of tomato puree, you can count
as
a carrot.
Or a carrot, or, yeah.
Which is handy if you're doing things like stews or anything else, because it disappears very quickly
into it. And you can throw it into loads of things. Yeah, so it's good.
One close to your heart here. My 10-year-old daughter has been diagnosed with celiac disease. She is asymptomatic. We have started a gluten-free diet and joined the relevant organisations. But any tips for issues like cross-contamination at home and eating out?
Yeah, God, that's the hardest bit. And I always say that, obviously I work with the Celiac Society, and the gluten-free bread, gluten-free pasta, you can buy those things. It's the touching. And just for people who don't get it, if 20 millionths of this child's food is gluten, that is going to be enough to trigger damage to her gut, even if she doesn't feel it. And that's a key thing. So you need a separate toaster. And yes, if you put your toast into a toaster that's had gluten bread in it, it will come out covered in gluten.
No, does it?
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. So that's a big thing. You need a separate toaster. You need separate butter, jam, marmalade. Because, you know, you see a crumb in butter when you butter toast. That's 100 times the amount of gluten needed to make this child sick. Less than a crumb. Like, so it's the amount of gluten that would fit on the tip of a pin will be a trigger for it.
You and I were talking about this during the break, but I was when I was away the last week, I was in a Denny's with somebody who was celiac, and they had to ask whether or not the French fries were celiac. And I think it was to do with the oil that they were cooking.
So if you cook something like chicken nuggets in oil, the gluten goes into the oil. And then if you then cook chips in the oil next, the chips come out covered in gluten. And people do think it's crazy. And people do say, oh, the heat kills it. And you're like, oh, please, it's not a bacteria. So it is very hard. So it is that basically it's if something touches the food, it's no longer gluten free. So if you have a gluten free muffin that touches an ordinary muffin, it's not gluten free anymore. So celiacs are not actually crazy when they're saying I can't have this. They're the main things that I would look at with cross-contamination. And the other thing is wooden chopping boards, because, you know, if you cut in with the knife, it kind of goes into the wood a little bit. Sometimes the gluten can get in there. So they need, if you're using a wooden chopping board, a separate one that's just for the person who's celiac. But you don't need new frying pans and you don't need new sort of utensils and stuff like that. As long as they kind of go through the dishwasher and get a good wash, they're fine.
Talk to me a little bit about the reaction of people to those with celiac disease, because going back to my Denny's reference, there was a clear undercurrent in the person who was serving us that this was a complete pain and that really she should just get on with it and eat what she was given.
Well, the Great British Bake Off have, there's a complaint in from the Celiac Society in the UK about comments laughing at celiac disease and really making light of it. And that happens a lot because people do think it's a fad. You know, and it is annoying for restaurants. I'm not going to lie. It's tough. It's hard for restaurants to do it. And especially, you know, if the staff aren't familiar with it, they just think someone's being difficult and they're really not. And I feel so sorry for them. Like I'm a long time working at nutrition and the gluten-free diet is the most difficult diet. It's the most difficult because gluten is everywhere. It is in, you're talking about tomato ketchup. You can get gluten in tomato ketchup. You can get it in mayonnaise. You can just get it everywhere.
Of course, if you use flour as a thickening agent, there you go.
Yeah, you know, or rye or barley or anything. So yeah, it is. So yeah, the deep fat, the oil fryers, are, it's a real thing.
Good morning, Anton. Can you ask Sarah a good food source for calcium and vitamin D? I've been diagnosed with osteoporosis and I want to avoid taking calcium supplements. Why would you want to avoid calcium supplements first?
Some people just don't like taking them. Some people prefer to. And I would always be food first, because we do know that if you're getting your calcium from sort of things like dairy, it's absorbed really well. And the nice thing about dairy is it gives protein. And when we talk about osteoporosis, vitamin D, really important. Calcium, really important. But protein is also really important. And I find lots of people don't know that.
Because building your bones.
Yeah. So if you think of protein as sort of the scaffolding that you plug the calcium into. So calcium on its own won't do it. So food sources for calcium, hands down, your dairy is going to be your best. Your milk, cheese, yogurt, unfortunately, butter and cream are just not good, going to give you any calcium, which is a pity. If you don't take those, calcium fortified soy milk is excellent. Just make sure there is calcium added. They're going to work really well. Green veg and calcium doesn't really work. There's a bit of calcium in it, but there's a lot of obstruction to absorbing it. So having worked this out, it's 25 servings of broccoli a day or 120 bags of spinach a day if you're trying to get your calcium from green veg.
It's not broccoli.
No. So tin sardines actually are fabulous because the heating, the way they're heated in the can makes the bones edible. So if you actually eat tins of sardines with the bones, it's the same as a glass and a half of milk in terms of calcium. So they're fantastic for that. So they're kind of good places to go. For vitamin D, it's a supplement.
We're back to fish oil, Andrew.
No, not even just actual vitamin D supplements. So all of us in Ireland should be on vitamin D from October to next March, every single one of us. So all adults should be on 15 micrograms a day. You can get vitamin D in food. So oily fish like salmon and mackerel are good sources. You'll get a little bit in eggs, but you're never going to eat enough. So just bite the bullet and take the supplement for the vitamin D.
On the topic of protein, how much protein should I take daily in my diet? I am a 60 kilo female. I want to build up my muscles.
So I would say, how much do you want to build it up? So for people who are doing kind of average exercise, what we talk about is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram. So you can do the maths on that. Generally, if you're going to do a lot of exercise, if you're doing maybe marathon running, a bit of endurance, you're trying to build muscle, maybe 1 gram per kilo. So 60 would be, you know, grand. I do see people all been told, oh, you have to take 2 grams per kilogram, so up to 120 grams of protein a day. You definitely don't need to be doing that unless you like...
You're powerlifting.
Literally, like bodybuilding is for the Olympics kind of thing. So probably, you know, 60 to 70 grams of protein would be loads. But remember to count protein in your bread and your dairy, not just your meat and things like that, because otherwise most people end up going way over.
It has to be difficult, though, to figure out all of these. Or can you just get it off the back of the packets and work it out from that?
Or you can just go and see a dietitian. It's a funny thing, like I see people spending years trying to figure this stuff out. And you're like, just go and see somebody. Like, you'll go and see the physio to get the knee fixed. And in one session with the dietitian probably get you set up, you know.
I take meds for high cholesterol and high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Can I eat some cheese and the odd packet of crisps? I watch my diet and avoid a faulty few.
Absolutely, cheese. From a heart disease point of view, we don't see a link between cheese and heart disease, which is fantastic. Now, it can put up your cholesterol. It's a long and complicated reason why, although cheese can raise your cholesterol, it doesn't raise your risk of heart disease. It's to do with the calcium in it. Little bit of cheese is going to be fine. In terms of blood pressure, salt is one to really, really watch. And it's a huge thing. Crisps would be very high in salt. So as long as you're having absolutely nothing else salty that day. But the thing...
Salt is lovely though, Sarah.
Oh, but it's gorgeous. But we're designed to really like it. We really, really, really like salt. And so it's keeping light. But the thing about blood pressure, which most people miss, is it's not just reducing salt. Increasing fruit and vegetables, the potassium in that helps to lower your blood pressure. Low-fat milk and dairy also lower your blood pressure. And the big thing for blood pressure is a 20-minute walk every day. Just do it. Just get that done. It does amazing things for blood pressure. Get out, good brisk walk, 20 minutes a day will do fantastic things. And that way you could have your crisps once a week and probably be all right.
Another one says, I am allergic to shellfish. Will I ever grow out of this?
No. Once you're, now kids grow out of allergies if they, a lot of allergies when they're younger. So things like egg would be the most common allergy in Ireland. But things like kids who, babies who get egg allergy, cow's milk protein allergy, they generally grow out of it by about 4, even to about 8. So most of them grow out of it. If you still have it as an adult, no, it's pretty much there to stay. Now, there's some really interesting research looking at trying to manage food allergies. We've had some success with peanut allergy. Now, not to be tried at home, please. This is really important. This is definitely with doctors. So we're hoping in the future that might be something that we can work with. But at the moment, no. If you've been allergic and you're an adult, you're pretty much going to stay allergic.
I worry that I'm making this up, but I have a feeling that you told me at one point that there was commonality between certain allergies, that if you were allergic to shellfish, you were also likely to be allergic.
No, you were thinking about latex allergy and bananas. So they tend to travel together a little bit.
That if you're allergic to bananas, you're also allergic to...
Or if you're latex allergic, bananas can often be a trigger there.
But shellfish is a standalone.
There's histamine in shellfish, so you can be... It's not technically an allergy, but people will have a reaction to it. And histamine would be in things like strawberries and stuff like that as well. So that can cross over a little bit.
Well, very quickly then, one quick one. I have an autoimmune condition. Can you recommend foods to reduce inflammation and histamine, please?
Okay, so foods for histamine are shellfish. Certain fruit and veg, cheese, unfortunately, would be in there as well. But I would say to you, work with a dietitian on that one. In terms of autoimmune, very commonly linked with celiac disease, not always. So if you have celiac disease, you're likely to have other autoimmune conditions. Do not just go gluten-free, because that is all over the internet. If you have anything autoimmune, you should go gluten-free. Get celiac tested. If you are celiac, then yes, go gluten-free. If you're not, the gluten's not doing anything and you're going to be fine. Other than that, for autoimmune, we would look at fish oils to help reduce inflammation. So particularly a type of omega-3 called EPA, which really helps to reduce inflammation. So that as a supplement is excellent.
Sarah, as ever, thank you so much. Sarah Keogh, dietitian and founder of Eat Well.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.